Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, we are once again preempting our regular One Planet series because of this unprecedented political moment. Yesterday, President Biden announced that he will end his re-election campaign and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. The announcement came after weeks of public and private comments by Democrats calling on Biden to step down, low polling numbers, and a relentless focus on his age, especially after last month's disastrous debate. President Biden is expected to publicly speak in a couple of days. He is currently recovering from COVID. In a statement yesterday, Vice President Harris said, quote, "I will do everything in my power to unite the Democratic Party and unite our nation to defeat Donald Trump and his extreme Project 2025 agenda. Together we will fight and together we will win," end quote. As of this morning, Act Blue had processed more than $80 million online in the hours since President Biden announced he was stepping aside, according to the New York Times analysis. Act Blue is an online donation processing portal used by Democrats up and down the ballot. So how does this decision impact the presidential campaign moving forward? What are your thoughts on President Biden stepping down and endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris? Some major Democrats have also endorsed Vice President Harris, and some have not specifically directly endorsed her. So we'd love to hear your thoughts. What do you make of this announcement and this moment? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us again.
It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you. And Wanda Mosley is back. Wanda is Deputy Policy Director of Black Voters Matter, an organization that works to increase power in marginalized, predominantly Black communities. They believe that effective voting allows a community to determine its own destiny. Hi, Wanda. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's good to be back with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Wanda, let's start off with you. So many of us were wondering, what is Biden going to do? I mean, to the end, he said he was still in the race, and then he dropped out yesterday. What do you make of his decision?
I think what we witnessed yesterday from the president was one of the most selfless acts, maybe that we will ever see, from someone who works in a space that is not always there to support selfless acts. Obviously, being the leader of the free world, you have to be confident. You have to be strong. You have to be able to make decisions and to do what's right for the country. But oftentimes, politicians are in a space where they also represent a brand, if you will. And so they are always self-promoting because they're wanting to win. They're wanting to be able to be in that position of leadership. And so for the president to put the country over his own feelings, his own desires, his own wishes, was really and truly a brave act. It was also smart and strategic because he also knows the value that he has in the person that he selected to be his running mate 4 years ago in Vice President Harris.
And what are your thoughts about Biden endorsing Vice President Harris? Like I said, a number of prominent Democrats have endorsed her. Others have not. And we'll talk about that later in the show. Are you familiar with the Zoom call that reportedly happened yesterday? Actually, it did get coverage in the Wall Street Journal, but a number of people are tweeting that a last-minute Zoom call was started to endorse Kamala Harris, and 44,000 Black women signed onto this call.
Yeah, so I'm actually hearing that at one point the tally was up to over 50,000.
Wow.
And yes, I think that what you are seeing along with this nomination, along with the act of the president, is something that is unprecedented to most people. I'm not sure that this country, that this electorate is ready for the power that Black women are about to exercise in this presidential election, in this next 106 or so days. You are going to see the veracity, the tenacity, the brilliance, the passion of Black women to be able to turn out votes, to inspire people to vote, to bring truth, to bring integrity into a space, into politics, which is often dirty and ugly. But Black women, when organizing, when working together, have a tremendous power, again, that I don't think this country has ever seen. So I personally am excited to have a front row seat to watch what the sisters do as we rally around a woman that looks like them, that comes from a place that is similar to them, who is going to need cover from Black women, because the attacks from the right are also going to be unprecedented. All of the misogyny that we are going to hear and see, all the accusations that are going to be hurled at her, all the lies that are going to be told, all the personal attacks about her and her family. And so to see Black women galvanize the way that they did last night, to be able to offer cover and support for this presidential candidate, it is going to be something that we have never witnessed before. So everybody sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Well, and it's already getting ugly. We'll wait to talk about that until later in the show. But Wanda, what about this? I mean, just the fact that this is happening, because before this happened, a lot of people were saying, watch out. If you have some sort of open primary, you are going to make Black women very, very angry. So, I mean, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said this just a couple of nights ago. She said the high rolling donors are trying to push out Biden. And she said, watch out, because they're going to try to push out Kamala Harris also. So can you just talk about what you're hearing from Black women, what this means to very active Black women who are very active in politics?
I think that selecting anyone other than the vice president to be at the head of this ticket would have been disastrous, not only for the Democratic Party, not only for this country, but also for the world. There is a whole process by which all of these things happen. And to supersede that process because of a thought, this idea, this notion of operating from a place of fear, thinking that a Black woman cannot carry a ticket, it is preposterous. I know, again, I'm saying that there's a process to this. And so superseding that process would have been a smack in the face to Black women everywhere, especially when you think about Black women being the most important, constituent base to the Democratic Party. Black women are loyal in their support of the Democratic Party. But let me also say that Black women have a unique space in that at the same time to be loyal to the party, also pushing the party to do better. And so seeing someone who looks like them, someone that they can relate to with similar background, if she had been pushed aside, this race would have been over. It would have been done. This thing that I keep hearing people say about measuring the drapes, they could have measured the drapes, ordered the drapes, and had a date to install the drapes, because this election would have been over before it even started.
That is Wanda Mosley, Deputy Policy Director with Black Voters Matter, an organization that works to increase power and marginalize predominantly Black communities. If you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about your thoughts, what do you think about President Biden stepping down and endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris? What do you make of this moment? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're also joined by Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic. So, Alex, what are your thoughts? What did you make of yesterday's decision and how we got to this point?
I think how we got to this point was pretty chaotic, and it's hard to overstate just how, I think, nerve-rattling this was for many within the Democratic Party. You had a situation in which, voters had been expressing misgivings about Biden's age for quite a long time. This didn't boil up into a media story really until the publication of the Her Report in February. There's been a lot of kind of hand-wringing on this point in some sort of liberal and progressive circles. But when you look at the polling and when you went out and actually spoke to voters, they were saying the same thing consistently for a very long time, since well before the midterms, that they had real concerns about Biden's ability to see out a second term. And I think by the time you got to right after the debate, it was pretty clear that elites within the party had finally woken up to that. They were finally looking at polling and seeing a situation in which the president had a good message. They could run on a strong economy. They could run on not being Donald Trump. They could, you know, run on, you know, being a sort of steward for the country, that they were not going to, you know, remake the federal government in this kind of, you know, Heritage Foundation Project 2025 style. But that Biden increasingly seemed like he was not capable of getting out there and campaigning in that way. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of anxiety here. I certainly felt some of it. But I think what you're seeing here, and it was something that I had worried about considerably, is also about the strength of the Democratic Party as an institution. What you had for about a month was a somewhat Trumpian situation in which, you know, kind of against the polls, against the leaders of the party, one man and, you know, his not inconsiderable ego was sort of standing in the way. And, you know, if he had decided to just go ahead and run with this, then you would have, I think, had a situation that could have been very, very dire, especially when you look at some of the internal polls that Democrats have been circulating amongst themselves. So I think that this situation, it's a relief, but I think it's also, it's an exciting moment in a lot of ways. Kamala Harris, I think, is an interesting and an exciting candidate, and you're going to have a sort of speed run presidential campaign here, the likes of which, you know, we're certainly not used to in this, you know, 18-month campaign period. So I'm very interested to see what happens here, but I think at the same time, you know, this was a situation that I think was probably an inevitability. I think it's happening at the right time, right after the RNC. There's time for Kamala to get, you know, into gear.
Do you have any sense of what's happening among high levels of the Democratic Party? Because the Democratic Convention starts on August 19th. Should we be making anything of what the media is making something of, in that President Obama put out a statement but did not mention Harris, whereas others like the Clintons put out a statement and endorsed Harris? Is there anything to that? I mean, how is this all going to play out?
Yeah, so from my conversations, so admittedly fairly rushed conversations over the last 24 hours, it seems like there are three camps within the Democratic Party. There's a camp that is aggressively backing Harris. You've seen that she's raised an enormous amount of money over the last 24 hours. There's a camp that wants a kind of quasi-open convention that would create a process by which Harris could quote-unquote earn the nominee via some as yet undetermined organizational system. And there's a third camp which would like Harris to be off the ticket altogether. Now, and this has existed really for the last month, these sort of three camps. And for a while, I think that there were people who were trying to figure out how this kind of process would work. But what I've seen over the last 24 hours is the vast majority of people within the party that have power, even those who have misgivings for whatever reason, many of them, I think, somewhat ridiculous and unfounded about Harris's viability as a candidate, have just decided that, look, the only way that we can get through this is by a massive display of unity here. And that's, I think, really what we're seeing. I think there's a lot of anxiety about that, that people were concerned that once Harris became the nominee that, you know, you'd get a bad poll or just bad vibes or whatever, and people would jump ship. That really hasn't been the case. So Obama is really still kind of an outlier here, someone who is yet to come and back the back Harris's candidacy completely. But I think that the real telling thing here is that in the last 24 hours, there has been a rush of basically every viable Democratic gubernatorial figure who could run in this. They've all said, look, I'm backing Harris, you know, Pritzker, Whitmer, Beshear. So I think now the question, Whitmer, Newsom, right? The question now is going to be, okay, well, what does the best ticket here look like for Harris? What's the best way that Democrats can win those blue wall states? But also, again, you know, there's also a question too, does Harris's candidacy make Georgia viable again? Can she, if she picks Roy Cooper, could North Carolina possibly be on the table?
Before we get to calls, I just want to ask you both about what your thoughts are on media coverage moving forward. Because we're already hearing about the Trump campaign, you know, going after Harris. I've already seen some tweets. I mean, I was thinking about not only would she be the first Black woman, South Asian president, she would also be the first woman without children. I mean, obviously the first woman president, although we should say that Hillary Clinton did get more votes than Donald Trump. It's just that she lost the Electoral College, so she did get more votes than Trump. But Kamala Harris does not have children of her own. She does have stepchildren. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting, because there's always a focus on the family. How many children does a woman have? And she doesn't have children of her own. I thought this is going to be fascinating to see how people talk about that. I was thinking of it in a positive way, but of course it took only a couple of hours for some, I don't even know what to call them, far right people on social media talking about how this is a liability. I won't even bother repeating what they wrote. But there's also some very ugly things out there, Wanda, and we can expect that it's going to get really ugly and very racist, because that's just who, you know, Trump is, and that's who he surrounds himself with. How do you think the media should deal with the sexism and the racism that is probably going to be unprecedented in the months to come?
I think it's important that real media, not the entertainment type of media, but the real media that deals with facts, that lives in reality, has an obligation to call that out. There's an obligation to point that out. There's an obligation to highlight some of these things that you mentioned. You know, we saw similar attacks in Georgia against Stacey Abrams, highlighting the fact that she was a Black woman who was unwed and didn't have children running to be governor. We're going to see some of the same types of attacks on the vice president, none of which has anything to do with her ability to lead this country. It didn't have anything to do with her being in the U.S. Senate, didn't have anything to do with her serving as vice president, and it will have nothing to do with her being a viable candidate for president, and then if elected, the president. But this is the day and age that we live in, because we have access to so much information, and there are so many different types of outlets that sort of quasi fall into the category of media. There is a thirst for information. And then you layer on top of that the overt racism that still exists in this country, the fear that is stoked by the right, but by anybody who doesn't look like them being in a position of leadership. Cover that with the lies that are told on the right to, quote unquote, gin up their base to get their people excited and motivated to come out. It is going to be ugly. It is going to be, again, unprecedented. I don't want to overuse that phrase, but this is new territory for all of us. Mm-hmm. And so because there isn't going to be a lot that they believe strategically that they can pick on in terms of her record, they're going to go for the lowest hanging fruit, the thing that is going to most excite their base, and that is going to be her gender, her ethnicity, and just the overall idea of a woman being in charge, but especially a Black brown woman. Is going to be the thing that they are going to focus on without a doubt.
What are your thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little bit on Friday's excellent show, but I think that, you know, the press, as we've seen, is heavily biased towards favoring internal division in political parties. And that has led to this bizarre and upsetting situation in which the Republican Party post-convention has been treated as if they were kind of all holding hands and singing Kumbaya. And that is certainly true superficially. But the message that they were singing was one of racial hatred. It was one of, you know, the deportation of millions of people. It was one of, you know, replacing the federal workforce with loyalist drones. And so I think that one concern for media coverage here is if there is kind of hemming and hawing on the Democratic side, or indeed if one of these, you know, unfortunate kind of in-season tournament style selection processes for a nominee are allowed to go forth, even if it's heavily weighted towards the vice president, that could overtake here. And that's one thing that worries me, is the sort of continuation of Dems in disarray. But you're not seeing that at all right now. I've not seen the Democratic Party this unified really since the tail end of Biden's candidacy in 2020. The other point I wanted to make briefly as well is that, yes, there have been really disgusting attacks on the right so far, but I think what you're seeing from Republicans, including the former president Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance, is what looks like desperation to me. They had really counted on running against a historically weak candidate, a candidate that, you know, by some, be it most polls, essentially between 75 and 80% of the electorate believed was unfit to serve another 4 years. And they had counted on this. Trump's selection of Vance is proof positive that they thought they were going to run up the score here. He selected his most extreme and frankly off-putting possible vice presidential candidate. And, you know, my sense right now is that they are feeling very anxious about that. And the attacks that you're seeing, though they are disgusting, they also haven't cohered into anything that feels remotely plausible as a winning message against Harris. You've got Donald Trump calling her laughing Kamala. You have these ridiculous attacks about her not having children. I think that, you know, as we go forward, there's going to be, to Wanda's point, I think one of the most, if not the most disgusting race baiting campaign imaginable. And I think Harris's role as the sort of quote unquote immigration czar will play a role in that as well. I'm certainly, you know, not looking forward to covering that. But what we're seeing now is the right, in fact, in disarray. They have not figured out what their line of attack is going to be here. Instead, you're just getting a bunch of nonsense.
We have an email from Melissa who writes, as far as hearing ugly things, the bar is set rather low. Trump is a sex offender and a convicted grifter. Thank you for that email, Alyssa. Let's go to a few calls before we take a break. And thanks to these callers for waiting patiently. Let's hear from Suzanne in Hillsburg. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there, Rose. Thank you for all your wonderful shows. I just want to ask your guest today. Okay, so we all know that President Biden has COVID. They say he's doing well, but if he's doing well, why hasn't he come on national TV and told the world, I'm resigning? Also, if he is really sick, why doesn't he give the presidency to Kamala Harris for the time being? Because if something happens to our country or any other country, somebody needs to be on top of it. And it sounds like he's not at the moment.
Well, thank you for that. Alex, do you have any sense of what's happening with President Biden? A lot of people are wondering why he decided to announce this online and you know, put a statement on Twitter, of course, but not speak. I'm reading that he's planning to speak this week. What are you hearing?
Yeah, so I think the expectation is that he will speak later in the week. One of the things that I think is gone somewhat unremarked here is that the rollout of this announcement was botched in two ways. I think, well, three ways, really. One is that it came as a surprise to a huge number of Biden staff. And look, you know, Biden has been around for a very long time. He has never had a reputation as a strong administrator in this regard. He's run a very strong administration, but staff that I've talked to were blindsided, including some members of staff that had been, you know, really beating the drum that he was not going to drop out. Two was that there was not an explicit endorsement of Harris in that announcement. That came via a separate tweet slightly later, but still not there. And three, we can only guess about why this is and why he hasn't spoken. My sense, or at least my sort of educated belief here, is that, you know, this is a decision that obviously Biden took a long time to arrive at, but I think the actual decision to bow out happened quite quickly. I think it really was arrived at on Saturday evening, thanks in part to the intervention of Nancy Pelosi, and that, you know, I think that the president is still emotionally processing that he is not running for another term. And again, I think that he's also ill. As for the question of resigning, this was something that had concerned me quite a bit, you know, once the calls for Harris had started to increase. But I think that, you know, there's nothing to suggest that, you know, contrary to the right's arguments, that he is suffering from severe cognitive decline. He's just getting older. I think that there's no reason to believe that the president is incapable of running the government for another 4 months or 5 months. And that, you know, resigning, I think, would create a difficult situation in which, you know, Harris would then be owning the administration completely and running for president at the same time. I think the ideal situation is one in which Biden is still kind of managing things, and he can, I think, make a plausible argument that says, look, I've got the energy to, you know, keep this ship afloat. I've got the energy to deal with the threats posed by, you know, Putin and Xi Jinping and whoever else. But I just don't have the energy to do the job for another 4 years. And again, you know, this election is not for who's running the country for the next 5 months. It's for who's running the country, you know, 4 years from now. So I think that him staying on, you're going to see a lot of attacks on this point. J.D. Vance has already started deploying them. I am skeptical that they'll be particularly effective.
NBC has a very long article about how this all played out. This is according to many interviews. According to this piece, President Biden has been very angry over the past week with close allies that have called on him to step down. And according to this report, White House and campaign officials, mostly found out along with the rest of the world when Biden published his post on Twitter. The same was true for Democratic National Committee officials and state party chairs. Senior Biden aides scrambled to set up separate meetings to talk to staff members for the White House and the campaign, reassuring the political aides that their jobs were safe. So, Alex, it sounds like he barely told anyone, and it sounds like he was very, very angry about all of this. Some of his close allies said, think about it. If you lose to Trump, your legacy just is ruined for the rest of your years.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the point, I mean, I guess I just dinged him on not telling people, but I think, you know, they were, one, keeping this very close to the vest. I mean, by the end, my understanding is that Biden was really only listening to a handful of people, and two of them were close family members, his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, and his son, Hunter. But I think they didn't want this to leak out at all before, and that's one reason. But you also see that in I think, the sort of botched job here as well. As for Biden's anger, I mean, I think, you know, look, this is someone, there's always been kind of two sides to Biden. I think there's the side of him that you've seen in some of the most moving political addresses that I've ever seen, a kind of empathetic, generous Biden, someone who is actually seems capable of having a real human touch. But this is someone who, you know, has been in politics since 1972. He possesses a not inconsiderable ego. He is someone who I think still bears a significant grudge for being kind of, you know, gently pushed aside in 2016 in favor of Hillary Clinton. He was, of course, mourning the death of his son, Beau, at the time, which I think would have hampered any entry into that race anyways. But, you know, this up until the sort of dam finally broke here, I mean, we were seeing one of the more kind of petulant and egotistical performances that I can think of, I guess maybe non-Trump division, at least in my time covering politics. And I think that, you know, it finally, what finally broke him was partly that the party started conducting internal polls again. They had not been polling swing states for several months leading up to this. And I think what they saw, or at least my understanding of what they saw, I haven't seen the polls, although I've talked to people who have, is that there was a collapse of suburban voters here, like an absolute collapse. So New Mexico was on the table, Virginia was on the table. These are safe blue states. So you know, we were looking at an absolute decimation of the Democratic coalition. And I think Harris, to Wanda's point earlier, has an opportunity not just to bring a lot of that back, but to, you know, expand and grow that coalition and to compete in some states that Biden certainly wasn't capable of.
Well, thanks again for the call. And again, we are expecting to hear from President Biden any day now. That is Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic. Wanda Mosley is deputy policy director of Black Voters Matter, an organization that works to increase power in marginalized, predominantly Black communities. Today, we are talking about this monumental announcement from President Biden. He will not continue to seek a re-election, and he has decided to endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. What do you make of this news? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by the Reverend William Barber, who is one of the leaders of the Poor People's Campaign. We will talk about his new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. He says there are 40 million more poor white people than Black people, but most Americans continue to think of poverty as solely a Black problem. He asks, why is this so? What are the historical causes? And what are the political consequences of that result? He says, unless we face the realities of white poverty, we cannot solve or comprehend inequality in the richest country in the world. We hope you can join us on tomorrow's show with the Reverend William Barber. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email your call at kalw.org. Today, we are talking about the major news that we heard yesterday. President Biden said he will end his reelection campaign and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris. We're talking about it with Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic, and Wanda Mosley, deputy policy director with Black Voters Matter, an organization that works to increase power in marginalized, predominantly Black communities. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We do have full lines, so if you can make a statement or ask a question as briefly as you can, that would be great so we can get to as many people as possible, and then we will get our guests to respond. Let's hear from Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and I want to express, as a lifelong Californian and a Jewish American woman, my absolute joy and delight. We're going to have a Jewish first man, so that's interesting. Kamala Harris, the fact that a Black woman with solid pro-choice values and a working mother being in charge of the world's largest economy is a thrilling, thrilling idea. When Harris ran for president, she had three big issues. First, abolish the death penalty. Second, encode reproductive choice in the Constitution. And third, legalize marijuana, which means Mary is going to be a legal person for the first time in her 70 years. I'm absolutely thrilled. And for vice president, my suggestion is Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, a Rhodes Scholar who has credible legislation of his own to legalize marijuana. So we are talking about this, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Mary. I'm glad you brought up these issues because we're obviously going to do many shows about issues in the months to come. I do want to spend a little bit of time on abortion, though, Wanda. I think this is so important. I knew we were not going to hear about abortion at the Republican National Convention. That really was not news, because whenever you take this issue to the most conservative states in the country, when it's taken to the people, they vote for reproductive rights. That is just a fact. So we've got an extremist like J.D. Vance saying in 2022 that he would like abortion to be illegal nationally. Donald Trump says he wants to take it to the states. Okay, well, if that's the case, Vice President Kamala Harris has been traveling the country. This doesn't get that much attention. Traveling the country, talking to people about how abortion bans have affected their lives. She said the overwhelming majority of Black women live in the South. Well, except for Virginia, abortion is illegal in the South. And this is having horrific, horrific ramifications. So can you talk about this, Wanda? Because President Biden was clearly not comfortable talking about abortion. He rarely even used the word abortion. Whereas Kamala Harris knows firsthand what people are dealing with because of these bans.
Yes, I do believe that this is going to be the main issue for focus for the Democratic ticket. I think that this is an issue that crosses the ideological spectrum, because women, young girls, mothers, grandmothers, aunties are extremely concerned about not having access to care for pregnant people. This is something that we have seen across, as you mentioned, Rose, even some of the more conservative, quote unquote, red states, be an issue that women are willing to cross over to the other side. Because politics aside, we are talking about people's lives. We are talking about their ability to receive life-saving care. We are talking about the long-term ramifications of not receiving that care. And so when we think about all of the other issues that are going to be discussed, this issue of having the right to have access to care, for healthcare providers to render service and aid for which they took an oath, for keeping politicians out of hospitals and exam rooms, for giving people, women, the opportunity to decide and make choices that are best for them, their family, based on whatever reasoning they want to use, is of great importance. We know that the GOP has a hard line when it comes to reproductive freedoms and reproductive rights. We also know that it is there in their playbook to tell lies, to talk about all the false narratives about when these abortions would take place. And so, again, that's a narrative for their side to hang on to. That is what they will use to motivate their base. They will also try to use religion. I would push back on religion to say, well, if we're going to talk about religion, can we talk about empathy? Can we talk about recognizing, acknowledging someone's suffering and their humanity? And so this is going to be the issue where Vice President Harris is going to shine, as she has already done, traveling to many states, having conversations, sitting in living rooms, looking people in the eye, hearing stories, and understand the struggling and the suffering. Understanding that where we are in this country right now, that a young girl, seventh grade in Mississippi, is going to be forced to give birth to a child that is a result of rape. This is a horrific time for our country, and I believe that women across the board are going to galvanize around this issue. And that is going to probably be the thing that decides who will be in the White House next year.
And we should say, you know, you have someone like a Donald Trump who, when he was running for president, told MSNBC's Chris Matthews that there has to be some form of punishment for women who have abortions. I'm not sure why we're not hearing that on a regular basis in the media. Again, J.D. Vance supports a national ban and rejects exceptions for rape and incest. It's important to remember, and I'm reading from a Guardian piece, July 2022, the case of a 10-year-old child rape victim in Ohio who was six weeks pregnant, ineligible for an abortion in her own state, was forced to travel for Indiana for the procedure. This happened because of Ohio's six-week trigger ban. I mean, Wanda, these stories are so important. And, yeah, and it's like because the Republicans aren't talking about it, it doesn't mean the media should not be highlighting these stories and what these guys have said.
Exactly. I think it's crazy when you start off by saying punishment for abortion. You mean punishment other than dying? You mean punishment other than the long-term effects of not receiving care? You mean that's not punishment enough? You mean, like you said, being forced to give birth to a child that is the victim, that is the result of rape? That's not punishment? The maternal mortality rates for Black women in this country rival that of third world countries. We know that Black women, Black people will die trying to give birth. So that's not punishment. And you're right. I don't understand why more of the national media doesn't call this out. I think we're in a place and time where it's easy to just talk about this type of thing as policy and take away the human aspect of it. And so when I do see people like the woman in Texas who come forth to tell their stories, and we do see that, you know, there's power in humanizing something like this, and it makes it real. It brings it into someone's home because, again, we have got to understand the death rates. We've got to understand the emotional and the psychological toll and the long-term effects of taking away access to choice and access to health care for women and pregnant people in this country.
Midas News just put out a story about J.D. Vance when he was running for Senate in 2022. He was on Fox. And he said that we're effectively run in this country via the Democrats by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. It's just a basic fact. You have Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC. The entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children, said J.D. Vance. How does that make any sense when we've turned our country over to people who don't have a direct stake in it? I mean, Alex, people are not, this is going to backfire. People are not going to buy into this.
No, I mean, I think it gets to what I was saying earlier to an extent, that they just do not know what argument they're making against Harris. And that's crazy to me because they should have been anticipating that this was going to happen since June 28th or, you know, 11 p.m. on June 27th. But I think that one of the things that we are seeing, you know, over the last month, which was extremely concerning for Democrats, is, you know, there are a lot of women voters, particularly suburban women voters, who were saying essentially, you know, look, abortion is the most important issue to me, but I have real concerns about President Biden's fitness for office, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And, you know, for the last 3 years, you've seen this is a winning issue, not just in blue states, but in Ohio and Alabama and Kansas. You know, it's been the Democrats' strongest issue, but they have not had a presidential candidate who can push it. In the debate, notably, the section on abortion, Biden, for some reason, began talking about crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. This has been Harris's strongest issue by far over the last 3 years. And it's going to be, I think, an extremely powerful and important one because it has galvanized voters. Voters are angry at Republican policies here. And I think the other thing, too, which has, I think, been relatively unremarked upon in the larger media story about abortion as well, is that it lines up perfectly with the Democrats' larger case against the Trump ban's ticket, which is that it's not just that Trump is a budding authoritarian, it's that they're pushing this Heritage Foundation Project 2025, which seeks to remake the federal government in an activist way, in which sort of right-wing, unpopular Christian nationalist policies are constantly being rammed down the throat of Americans. And that, I think, is a winning message. It's one that the current president has failed to push, but I think Harris is very well positioned to make that happen.
Alex, I also want to quickly ask you about Gaza before we get back to calls. The Nation reports that more than 500,000 Democratic voters have told Biden, "Save Gaza." The campaign to use uncommitted primary votes to send a message to Biden has won 24 delegates, and it keeps growing. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to address Congress on Wednesday. A number of Democrats are planning to either not show up or protest. I'm really curious to see, what is Kamala Harris planning to do? Is she going to shake hands, take a photo with Netanyahu? And just one more point before you respond. NBC has a piece out that says Harris may be more willing to criticize Netanyahu than Biden. And it says Harris is widely expected to continue Biden's foreign policy if she succeeds him, but that might not be the case when it comes to Netanyahu's approach to the assault in Gaza. In March, White House National Security Council officials toned down part of Kamala Harris's speech about the need for a ceasefire and a hostage release deal. They also say she expresses more empathy for Palestinians than Biden. What's your read on this one? I mean, this is a huge issue. The New York Times has a video of hardcore Biden supporters in Michigan who say they are, well, before this happened, before he dropped out, but they said they are not going to work for Biden or vote for him because of what he has done in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think almost any Democrat would be less friendly to Netanyahu than Biden has been. I think this is a story that has been undercovered in the press pretty substantially, in part because it involves Arab American voters who often don't live in places where large media organizations are, but two, who the press has never covered extensively, to all of our detriment. But you know this, and I think again the other element here as well is young voters, right? The Biden strategy for re-election always ran through older white voters and suburban women. Harris has an opportunity to shift that. And I think that, you know, politically speaking, there is a cleaner and broader coalition here that involves a stronger recognition of the humanity of Palestinians, but also the brutal and immoral and horrific campaign in Gaza. Biden has not done that at all. There is a needle to thread here to some extent, you know, in terms of keeping together a fraying Democratic coalition, but I think one of the other elements here is that, you know, just by virtue of not being Biden, of not, you know, embracing Netanyahu, of not giving the Israelis cover to commit human rights abuses in Gaza, as they've been doing for 10 months, that will help, one, will benefit Harris politically, but I think it's also just a moral imperative, and it shows the type of leadership that voters have not seen from Biden. I think an underrated aspect of his decline in the polls is actually that it stems from, unfairly or not, from foreign policy failures, that voters first sort of rejected him during the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think there were concerns about his handling of Russia after the invasion of Ukraine, but I think it's been most justified in his handling of Gaza, where he has either been absent, as he has been for most of the last 6 months, or he has been giving explicit political and moral cover to an Israeli government that is, one, brutalizing and murdering thousands of civilians, but also that has not shown any sign that it has a plan for Gaza after the war, or even for that matter, to end the war itself. And here is, I think, where Harris can really step up.
Well, we're going to cover this issue on Thursday's show. Wanda, do you have anything to add? Does anything strike you about what you're hearing from Black voters on Biden's policies on Gaza? And how do you think this news might change things?
Yeah, we definitely saw a lot of protests at colleges and universities, including HBCUs, where students were extremely upset by the lack of action by the president regarding, enacting some type of support for people, the Palestinian people. Watching the genocide live on social media was very disturbing for a lot of young people, and quite honestly, it turned off a lot of young voters. And so I do believe that, you know, there is an opportunity, like Alex said, for the vice president to shift some of that, some of the concerns held by young people, to offer a slightly different approach to handling this particular crisis. And so it is going to be interesting to watch and see, you know, what role this particular issue plays in the presidential election, because we know that, you know, listen, the other side isn't going to do anything better. But there is a lot of concern, and there are a lot of people who want to hold account the current administration and their policies regarding the genocide of the people of Gaza.
Well, we're definitely going to be talking about this more in detail on Thursday's show. We have an email from Wayne who says, can you please ask Ms. Mosley whether Kamala Harris can galvanize male Black voters to back her? Also, why do Black leaders support the Republicans and Trump, who have spent decades trying their best to suppress Black voting rights?
So I'll start with the second part because that's easiest. I don't know of many Black leaders who are supporting the former president. You would have to give me some specific names. I mean, other than maybe some of the current members of Congress who see some benefit for themselves. I think that, you know, I don't know, maybe some feel like they are held in higher esteem when they go to the, when they're a part of the GOP. I'm not really sure. I haven't really honestly spent much time speaking with or engaging with folks on that side. But in terms of, you know, the vice president's ability to appeal to Black men, I mean, listen, Black men, they all mostly, not all, but most will have Black mothers, Black grandmothers, Black aunties. And so being raised, many of them by Black women, there is a certain level of respect and love that I feel is going to come to the forefront for some, not all. I mean, if I'm going to be completely honest in this moment, we did see some of the negativity against Stacey Abrams when she ran for governor in Georgia. But I do believe that the overwhelming majority of Black men are going to be in support of the vice president and her bid to become president. I believe that we're going to see some galvanizing in the Black community in terms of being able to fully support this candidate, coming together and making sure that she gets the support that she needs. You know, I wanted to go back really quick, Rose, about the announcement and some of the points that Alex made earlier about how it was botched in a lot of ways. And I agree, there was definitely some you know, sort of sloppiness and some glaring oversights, in particular in the initial announcement, not endorsing the vice president. But I'll also say, I also want to offer that the timing, I believe, of this announcement really worked in the favor of the vice president, her bid to become president. So this happened on a Sunday. So those who work, you know, the traditional work week were at home. For those of us on the East Coast and the eastern part of the country, it happened after church. It gave us a lot of time to talk amongst our circles, whether it be on social media, group text, chat, things like that, and then open the floodgates, you know, we talked about this at the top of the call, for that historic Zoom call that happened last night with Black women. And so couple that with the fact that it comes at the end of the Republican National Convention, where typically the party who has their convention will always see a bump in the polls, and there's always momentum, and there's always more donations and fundraising that happens. Well, I think that this announcement pretty much threw cold water on all of that, because now all of the headlines are going to go to this historic moment where we see a sitting president announced that he is no longer seeking re-election, and that his vice president, who is a Black woman, is now going to lead the ticket, and all the things that will snowball into the Democratic National Convention mean more headlines, more time to coordinate, more energy, more donations for that side. So I believe that the timing, while maybe not the way that some people thought it was going to happen, and maybe there are some hurt feelings that they didn't get a heads up, I think that in a lot of ways, this timing happened exactly as it needed to in terms of having strong support for the vice president and her candidacy.
Hmm. Yeah, if I could jump in quickly there, I just wanted to say,
just about 30 seconds left, Alex, and if you can tack onto that, a lot of emails about what happens next.
Yeah, I mean, to Wanda's point just now, I think that you're contrasting a Republican National Convention that, yes, it showed a lot of unity, but it was also missing George W. Bush. It was missing Mitt Romney, right? You look at what the Republican Party is now and you see a reflection of Donald Trump. And if you contrast that to what we've seen over the last 24 hours, it is an outpouring of nearly every national Democrat. Nancy Pelosi came out and endorsed Harris in the last hour. And I think what we're seeing now is a real groundswell of unity. I think that heading forward, I mean, we kind of have to see. This is uncharted territory. There's nothing we can compare it to, certainly in my lifetime, certainly in modern politics. But I do think that this is going to be an exciting sprint campaign. It's something that we're not used to right now. I think that Harris is going to galvanize voters. I think a lot of people are not appreciating just how big of a drag age was on Biden. And I think that also, you know, people wanted a new candidate. They did not want to vote for Donald Trump or Joe Biden again, and now they can't.
Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. Wanda Mosley is deputy policy director of Black Voters Matter. Thank you both so much for joining us. Thank you. And we hope you can join us tomorrow with the Reverend William Barber, one of the leaders of the Poor People's Campaign. He'll be talking about his new book, White Poverty. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.